Welcome back to Questions We Don't Have Answers. My name is Harrison Schutz, and a truck is passing by my window.
It's me in the truck, Donovan Morgan Grant.
Oh my god. Dude, that's awesome, man. But you gotta get a quieter car, man. It's so annoying. It literally drives me insane.
I love my gas guzzlers.
Yes. And speaking of gas guzzling, wait, no. Today, our question, how do we sell the future? Because I feel like this is a topic that we have been kind of circling around, or perhaps swirling down a drain towards, because it always comes up in these very discussions about like answers to questions we have, and it's always a matter of identifying the audience and trying to suss out how to communicate, because that is often a conclusion that we draw is communication for all of these issues as a kind of cheat, perhaps. The blanket answer is always communication. That is how society functions, by being itself. So how do we actually have those conversations? How do we actually communicate? How do we arrive upon the future that, as they say, liberals want? And that is going to be our situation for tonight. But first, I'd like to start us off with some fan mail, although that's probably a presumptuous term, with some communication, perhaps. So, Donovan, do you... Whoa, my balls dropped. Do you want the honors, or should I do it?
Oh, well, I'll get this taken care of real quick.
Okay.
And this is from a returning email, or from a returning emailer, a listener. And does the email indicate whether they want to their name read out, or did we say it before?
I think generally first name is okay.
Oh yeah, sure.
Maybe not, though.
we'll do the whole, Lisa S. No, it's too obvious. No, that's yeah. L. Simpson.
L. Simpson.
This is from Mariyama, and she's written before. And she writes again saying, "Dear Harrison and Donovan, could you please start off the episode with a definition on what you mean when you describe yourselves as liberals? I know the U.S. definition is slightly different to what we hear used in Europe. Here in the UK, we have our own right-wing Conservative Party, the left-wing Labour Party, and the centrist party called the Liberal Democrat Party. From what I've read, American liberals are on the left, but then how far to the left are you? Some people here in Britain joke that our right-wing party is more left-leaning than the Democrats in the US. What would the two of you both say you're as liberal as the other? Are there degrees of liberalism? Are there any typically liberal ideologies that you reject? Do you see a difference in liberal fiscal policies and in being seen as liberal socially? For example, being pro-abortion, a social policy, but anti-paid maternity leave for fiscal reasons. Sorry for not having an interesting contribution, but Googling the word has thrown up a lot of different definitions. It looks like everyone has their own idea on what being a liberal means and to hear how both of you both define the word liberal will make it easier to understand the podcast in the future. Thanks you so much for taking the time out to read my email, and also thank you for producing such an excellent content week in, week out. Mariyama." Thank you very much, Mariyama. We're both very happy to elucidate any sort of like vagaries from one country to another, because that's something I definitely am not, overtly familiar with. I've heard, when I'm looking up David Tennant on Wikipedia and it says he's part of the like the Labor Party, I'm like, I'm hoping that's liberal. but yeah, I'm unsure, and yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the political demographics are there. You know, if like saying that, you know, their right wing is more liberal than our right wing, I certainly hope so. But it's interesting because yeah, like she's right. There are definitely different. There are 50 shades of liberalism, all kinky, and I think especially nowadays it's so stratified, it's so partisan that we all on this show we very often, I honestly constantly characterize it as a battle between good and evil, like all you know like two dimensional thinking political people do, but I think liberal is generally, and I'm probably not the person to say this, but like it is more concerned with the well-being of the individual, whereas conservative is more towards, obviously there are like, you know, things like tradition and a specific idea of how things should go, whereas liberals are often characterized as, you know, quote-unquote forward-thinking people who are kind of into the future, like we're all now into how to bring about the future and what the future might look like and how people can be protected. The type of liberalism that we espouse, or type of liberal, of course, you know, I'm sure Harry and I feel that like every time Harry is more and more liberal, I find myself following him because he's always right. But I feel that like I'm just the kind of guy who tries to consider if it's a topic of discussion that concerns a type of person that I'm not considered, I try to take that into account, which ends up changing my way of thinking. For starters, what would you say about your own personal politics, Harry? How would you describe them?
Probably lengthy, so I'll try to keep this part. I mean, this could be the podcast because I also want to thank Mariama for identifying the accidental thesis of questions we don't have answers, which is probably just Donovan and I just trying to like define and identify ourselves in this way.
Absolutely.
But I mean, I think that like, for a lot of people, their political identity is kind of a byproduct of quote unquote pure beliefs, and so like they identify liberal on almost like happenstance because they believe in certain things. And the way that I would actually differentiate liberals and conservatives in America, and maybe this is, I've always thought this was just globally, just because it seems so logical, is that liberals have a very kind of wide love, but it is also a kind of abstract one, where they have this great love for the whole world, and conservatives have a very kind of specific, concrete love, but for their immediate area. And so their definitions of society and who counts are just very different in a quantitative manner. And like, I don't think either is necessarily evil from that point on, but Once they begin to manifest as like, you know, anti-gun control, then it starts to become a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I think... I really like the idea of working backwards from motivations, and for me, it's always just been about I am most compelled by suffering, and oftentimes that suffering is abstract, and for most of it, actually, because I haven't dealt with a lot of tragedy in my life. But like, you know, I am very affected by stories of people who are suffering, and so I think, how do I, or not how do I work to reduce that suffering, but what, like, who is doing that? And what do they think and what do they say? And that leads me to, you know, liberalism, I guess, rather than a kind of interest in my current station, because I'm not too happy with where I am right now. Like a lot of conservatives probably are, and they don't want to lose their station as they see it. But yeah, I don't know. Follow up thoughts on that one.
Yeah, Mariama, it is kind of tricky because like as Harry said, we always kind of try to distill it. Basically, I think if we were kind of differentiate ourselves from either, you know, sort of like the call out Twitter liberals, or like your basic, you know, like very platonic basic idea of a liberal, I think is like, I mean, I don't want to name names because I don't want to presume too much, but somebody who is, to me, it's always characterized by, yeah, like as you say, somebody who's kind of concerned for the well-being of a wide variety of people. A lot of our episodes, kind of, are, as you are aware, characterize, you know, trying to kind of think of the, like, people who are different than us, people like transgender community, to people who might be going through the type of like, you know, personal racial crisis. When we were mentioning like Rachel Dolezal in that episode, people who are not really taken into consideration when laws are made. And it's not, you know, I don't mean to characterize us as, you know, like we care when other people don't, but like that is sort of how liberal politics manifests itself in that way. But of course, you know, we're, you know, being guys, we tend to have a narrow view of who we care about in a given moment.
Yes.
But it is, I think we're generally seen as somebody chasing after an ideal where everyone can be happy, as opposed to keeping ourselves happy just the way we are, like Harry said. And I think that, you know, like, obviously, like conservatives are more, they find themselves more into gun rights and immigration laws and fiscal conservatism, which I guess is, like, you know, not spreading the world around and not being socialist. Religious
traditional
freedoms.
Traditional values, as you mentioned. Yeah, religious freedom.
Yeah, values which are seen as traditional, whereas I think liberals tend to reevaluate those values and try to see them with a new perspective that views from the past might not have granted them.
Mm.
And without sounding as douchey and dickish, I feel that like platonically those are sort of like, you know, ways you can kind of describe the differences between the two.
Yeah, in a general sense. And I think that you're right too, both of you, is that, there are degrees of liberalism. And frankly, like the question of which one of us is more liberal, like I don't think either of us could answer that. But it is definitely a competition. Like liberalism is this weird thing where people go head to head on Twitter, which is like pretty annoying. And in terms of the lengths of liberalism, I guess maybe that is kind of the terminating point for that question. But like, as far as I'm concerned, like I am tolerant of every human being up until like consent. that's kind of the line.
Interesting. Yeah. I think you know, not to shine ourselves up too brightly. I don't know if there's a lot of like conservative infighting unless you just get to like, you know, flat out, you know, people who align themselves with President Trump and people and conservatives who don't, or you know, conservatives who might find themselves aligning with the Nazis and conservatives who don't. That's sort of like the difference. Whereas with liberals, I find that, you know, it's basically like if somebody is aware or woke more so than the other person, then it becomes a lot of like, you know, sort of like label calling. Like, oh, well, you did this one thing, which means, you know, I should never listen to you again. And the person says, well, touche, because I can name this one also thing that you kind of did. And there's a lot of like, you know, a race to the finish line to see who is more diabolical than the other.
Yeah, and that's kind of like the are there any liberal ideologies you reject? Like, not really. I think it's more like kind of the different patterns or the nature of certain liberals that, like, I feel like a lot of liberals are very reactionary. And to say that sentence is just to say that, like, you know, liberalism is an identity that you choose. And so I don't think that's unfair to say or to, like, kind of generalize like that. Maybe it is. But I do see a lot of reactionary stuff on Twitter, and that's something that I definitely don't really like about our flock. But and then liberal fiscal policies. I mean, I remember like in high school, that's kind of like the libertarian test for people is because sometimes people will say like, oh, I identify as a social liberal, but I have like fiscal conservatism. Like that's how I lean, and that's just libertarianism. And what we find is that those two are not. You cannot. That doesn't make any sense. Then your fiscal conservatism cancels out your liberal socialism or social liberalism.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that like what we try to do, and I think that like this does separate us from a lot of people online, is that while a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of people who try to educate themselves on some issues. We try, and we do this too. We know we're not that different, but like that's the purpose of this podcast is to kind of really dig down to the root. That sounds so cliche, but like, you know, kind of figure out where a lot of these sort of, you know, ongoing discussions stem from, and kind of reverse engineer a response that we can kind of rely on, rather than just have a response that rely on, which might end up being hollow upon further review. And I think, you know, with a lot of people who don't tend to do that, it's a sign of their maturity, and you know, and their lack of interest in education. which kind of leads to the downfall of society and how, you know, a lot of people are suffering right now. But that's probably more than we ought to get into before this becomes another episode.
Well, hopefully that answered the question. I don't know, really. But I guess very tolerant of most people, except for those who are in our way, which is essentially, that's not true. But
yes, you're either with us or against us.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the problem, is that like I feel like the liberal and conservative divide is as much maligned by some people, and I understand why. Because, I mean, we're all human beings, and we all have these kinds of same tendencies and psychological whatever's the word that would make me sound smart there. Because I feel like, to some extent, our tolerance is tested a lot, or not tested a lot, and so when it is, we kind of show our true face. And so that's really the only time when we can say how liberal we are. And maybe it's an aspiration, and that's one thing. And I think that, I like to think that my tolerance has been tested and I have, you know, passed the Void Conf test, to be topical. But, you know, who knows? I mean, I don't really interact with a lot of people. And I find that when I do, I'm actually kind of a dick. Like, not to people, but I really just hate, like, a lot of people. And I have, like, zero patience. But, like, in a more important sense, I feel like I try to be like charitable and interested in people's issues and try to be a listener online, finding that the online space is usually be liberal in than the outside world or the real world, perhaps.
Well, that's always the thing. It's like that one thing you said back then, we're always more liberal than we're always not as liberal. We're never as liberal as we think we are, which I think is a very, a crushingly truth statement.
Yeah, sad.
But thank you very much for your question, Mariama. I think that was a very solid question that not only would apply to people who might be as equally confused as you were or still are, but also kind of serves to reiterate what we try to do with this podcast and end up failing. Moving on
to the failing, to the main event.
The failing. How do we sell the future? So this is sort of, you know, sort of like kind of a stopgap on our episodes to kind of say flat out, what is the future look like and how can we get there? Yeah. Should there still be a future to get to reach?
I believe yes, damn it. This is 70 sci-fi ending.
I should hope so. And the following features we find will be sort of, you know, the way to that future. I don't think any of these are really debatable in terms, you know, of a positive good. Well, I guess gun control. Spoilers. But, we've listed a few. I mean Harry. Gender equality, racial equality, freedom of bigotry / intolerance, gun control, universal health care, meaningful democracy, and better education.
As a start.
As a start, yes. That's what we would like the future to look like. That's, I believe, what people in politics try to have the future look like eventually. And I think that's what we would like to see for ourselves. So this is obviously a very loaded episode or discussion topic, because a lot of these, any of these could be its own episode. But I think kind of opening up the floodgates, you know, sort of approaching the end goals for any of them might, you know, we might land on some, we might miss on others, but it's worth a shot.
I mean, I think, like, just the idea of getting these ideas out there on paper for just our own sake, really, because I feel like a lot of the battle, if things go as they have been or whatever, following a pattern, like, a lot of the battle is going to be fought, you know, with words and stuff and through rhetoric. And so I feel like the faster that any one of us individually can concrete our answers and our thoughts on how we arrive on the future, the better we can kind of argue for them. And so that's kind of the goal with this episode, is to work backwards from those features of our perfect future, our ideal future, and you know, think, how do we get there? And how do we kind of approach the arguments against those features and their symptoms or what have you?
Yes, exactly. So did you want to go in the order of these that's listed, or did you want to just start off with anyone that you were to talk about at first, or how did you want to approach this?
I'll open the floor to you on how, maybe, I don't know, actually probably just go in order, I guess, might as well. It's all,
that's what I was going to do too.
Arbitrary.
just to see how it goes. Yeah, just kind of go down the list. So yes, the first, umbrella topic we have is gender equality. And there are a number of obstacles to achieving this. Some that are included are pay gap, pay wage gap, the glass ceiling, representation, and of course, you know, a lot of this regards to women. I don't think there's any sort of, you know, the only thing that I think applies to men that is sexist against men are, like, you know, how men are disproportionately imprisoned based on being men. Not so much based on being men, but, like, you know, there is a sexism against men in terms of how the prison system works. That,
sure.
I'm not required to talk about too much, but that is absolutely a sexist factor.
Yeah.
Now that that's been mentioned, the fact of the pay gap, the glass ceiling, representation in the media, representation of women in politics, representation of women in the workplace, representation of women in professional sports, representation of women in the military, and the idea of male genocide.
The ideological virus.
Snicker, snicker. There are with all of these little subtopics and our umbrella topics, we have, or maybe not all of them, but like most of them, we have proposed solutions to them. And yeah, I mean, we have a few. I don't want to necessarily like list them all. Like how would you want to kind of approach each of these?
I mean, this podcast might be kind of dry structurally because I feel like we pretty much just have to go answer by answer, putting them to the test and coming up with the arguments against them and how we can, and maybe we don't come up with anything at all, but if it can kind of jog the listener's mind or if they want to add their voices to the mix, because this is, I mean, the end product of this is going to be pretty pathetic, I think. It's going to be like you guys tried to come up with answers to society and you come up with a 6-page Google document. So, I mean, no matter what, it's going to be insufficient, but I feel like if we can kind of do anything at all, or list or come up with anything, then, you know, it's more for the idea of the exercise or whatever. I'm just saying words now. But yeah, answer by answer, I think, is kind of how we're going to have to do this, at least starting out.
This episode also presumes that the listener fully is aware or understands these problems.
That's true.
Because I think that we have pretty good listenership, but, like, I, you know, you ever know that someone's listening to this and hears things like, because people are like, oh, the pay gap is a myth. And the glass is a myth. You know, there is no, you know, everyone has this, a fair shot. You know, but these are things that, like, I think the majority of intelligent America understands.
And honestly, I think for tonight, we're probably only going to do gender and racial just because we only have, like, an hour and a half, maybe.
Yeah, it's starting pretty late. My fault.
All good. Or actually, do you want to do, like...
I'm not for giving it a shot, but if we go too long, then we'll stop. But
I feel like we have to hit on gun control tonight.
Yes. Yeah, as opposed to... I don't know what to say about the auto industry, to be honest.
It's part of the future, damn it. Yeah,
I was totally going to just like sit down with that one.
I have no idea either. Whatever. I just know that people think about it, I guess. Elon Musk, perhaps.
I can barely like separate an Elon Musk from the car of the future.
Yeah, I know. That sucks.
But with the pay gap, I mean, a lot. I want to say that a lot of these, I feel that like this is one of the episodes, one of the very, very few, where my research has been a lot more effort intensive than other.
Yeah, you did a lot.
I tried. Because there are, if you research this, there's, and the pay gap in of itself. Start off with that. The pay gap between men and women. It is a very complex issue. It involves a lot of economy. There is these sort of, you know, the saying that women are only paid like 78 cents to the dollar of what men are paid, and people are saying, well, that's not technically true. And there's actually it's true in a sense. If basically if men and women did the exact same job for the exact same amount of years, with all the factors of being a man and woman, a woman will end up being paid 78 cents to the dollar of a man. In broad strokes. I know there's a lot more that goes into that, but that's essentially the general truism of the topic. Mm. If you look up proposed, or basically if you literally Google solutions to solve the pay gap, there are a number of, you know, like, oh, here's 10 reasons why, or here's 10 ways to solve it, or whatever. So what I did was basically look up I found commonalities within each list. It's not, obviously, every list didn't have every single of the same thing. Some had difference. Some had opposite answers. Some had, but the ones I listed on, or about to list off, were ones I found in a lot of, virtually all of them, one form or another. Like, in each list, one of the answers that I found was at least in one of them, or showed up more than others. So there's pay transparency. Pay transparency is basically, and I've not necessarily come across this in my work experience, but, like, you know, basically being very upfront with how of what every person makes. I guess it's an actual, like, you know, real life job. Like, I'm not sure if that's a law or basically a rule of thumb for most companies that you can't talk about your wage or your salary or your individual how much you get paid. But, like, basically being transparent and upfront with that, because, you know, like women will find out, or may not find out, that they're not getting paid as much as their male coworkers because it's being kept intentionally secret or some such thing. Raising the minimum wage, better access to childcare, eliminating negotiation. Women often have to negotiate starting wages, and women often tend to lower their wages or go for lower wages than expected. While men often try to haggle and be paid more than they're expected, and they tend to have that happen for them. Usually when women try to say, well, I think it should be paid this, well, when women start off with this, you know, they will not tend to get it. If men do that, they're more likely to get paid that higher wage. So eliminating the negotiation would be a way to kind of stamp out that element of the pay gap. Flexibility in hours. If a woman is trying to return to work after maternity leave, she can still work and, you know, earn her money without having the pay, whether it's paid or not, maternity leave kind of, you know, implement or impede that yearly wage. And of course, recognizing factors that would lead to pay disparity. Basically, implement in the company's computer or the hiring system how different factors could hinder a woman's pay compared to a man's. There's an article somewhere, it'll be on the show notes, that talks about how when women, you know, most women, I'll probably get this with the glass ceiling bit, but most women who work in jobs that are occupied by a man, they will not get paid more. But if a man works in a job occupied by a woman, as in, like, nursing or teaching or whatever, they will get paid higher than a woman might be. And that makes no sense. So, in fact, being aware of those types of factors and that kind of reality can help to, as well as the others, can help to stamp out the pay gap. Thoughts on any of those, Harrison?
I mean, unfortunately, for a lot of these topics and a lot of these answers, the underlying problem is going to be kind of the original problem, and in this case, that's sexism. But I feel like there's solving sexism, and there's also short-term or quote-unquote short-term solutions that could work towards that. Because, like, I remember reading a story about a police officer who was, like, the one of three women on the force who was pregnant and, like, is now suing her department with the ACLU, I think, because of discrimination. Like, she was, like, busted down a post and, like, it's just, like, got completely fucked over. And I think that a lot of that came – or not, I think. It seemed from the story that a lot of that just came from sexism, that, like, people didn't want to accommodate for – her womanliness. Like, they didn't want to give her armor that fit her fucking body that expanded because there was a baby inside. Like, that's like gross negligent, or not, I guess, not gross. It's gross in one sense, I guess, but that's a specific term, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, like, a lot of, like, pay transparency, like, when I feel like when we're younger, we kind of don't understand, like, the logistics of the world. And so I was always of the assumption that, like, why wouldn't that be a thing? Like, payroll, like, people who work in the payroll department know what, you know, they would be able to debunk the pay gap myth, or confirm it or whatever, because somebody knows what everybody's making. I guess it's a matter of how do you make it so that everybody knows that or something like that? And yeah, I think that the problem with that one is always, like, it's just how do you do it? And the same thing with, recognizing the factors and eliminating negotiation. Like, I mean, for the negotiation, like, that's also, I mean, it's probably symptomatic of just how women kind of move up in a company. And again, that has a lot to do with implicit bias and sexism and stuff like that. My favorite feminist, Rebecca Bunch, talks about this, where she's like, you know, a man walks into the job interview and or a woman walks in and a raise doesn't even occur to her. And the man walks in, and he's like, what are my benefits? And so, I think, as you were saying, like, there is definitely that chief difference that is rooted in a deeper something. So I guess the question is, like, how would we kind of make these changes happen? Because I agree that, you know, these are changes that would obviously help in like a one-to-one mathematical way. And so I think the question is always going to be how. And legislation, like through the government, is one method, sure. But, you know, given our current state, that's not going to happen. And so I think maybe it could even fall on a company or a corporation to kind of lead the charge on this. And would, you know, could we prove that it is like more profitable or better for your company to be transparent with your pay, to not have a ridiculous negotiation process for raises, to be flexible, to just kind of be more open about that, to have a good fucking policy for, you know, when people get pregnant. Because I mean, that's probably almost a separate issue that we'll circle back to. But I think that could be something, is to look almost like however we would make that happen, like putting pressure on like Netflix or some shit, or somebody who's kind of progressive when it comes to company politics and the cultures of the workplace, relatively so. I mean, obviously they're a multi-billion-dollar company, so who knows, but they seem to have been. I feel like if a company could prove that these things did not affect the bottom line, because they shouldn't if you're smart about it, then that would be a way to overturn a lot of those problems.
Yeah, I've in my research today, apparently there are definitely laws that try to, you know, that you cannot discriminate between the sexes in working things, you know, things like transparency or negotiation. So something like that, like there are laws try to prevent that, but they're not properly implemented. Mm. Like, they're not really being paid much attention to, and I think that, like, you know, higher punishment or more visible, more strict punishment might be a way to kind of, you know, keep that in play, where it's like, you know, that's just not okay. You can't just like chuckle and slack off while you light your cigar. Like no, straight up, that should be grounds for like instant removal if you just allow that to occur, because these are your workers. You know, you're not supposed to treat this like a boy. You're not supposed to treat this business like a boys' club. These are your workers trying to work for you, and you're supposed to be your type of unit. You're sabotaging your own unit for that way.
Mm. Yeah, and I feel like a lot of companies don't put a lot of stock into like employee satisfaction, or maybe even that's an American problem, right? Like, we don't have siesta like certain South American countries, or maybe it's just Spanish speaking people or whatever. But like, I feel like maybe this is just complete apocrypha or just mythology or whatever, but like, people say that the 4-day week is actually makes you more productive. Being as somebody who's like in kind of a crunch right now at work, I can definitely see that. But, you know, I feel like, you know, I mentioned Netflix and that just popped into my mind, but for like a reason. Like, Reed Hastings circulated that very influential PowerPoint presentation about how key to Netflix's early success was, I think, actually also following a Facebook model, but definitely putting a lot of stock in employee satisfaction and making sure that it didn't become a toxic workplace environment. That is a thing even before gender enters in the equation. He talks about how he would eliminate quote-unquote brilliant jerks, which is essentially like the Don Draper-style character who comes in and is just like a dick to everybody, but he gets the job done, damn it, and he's so smart. That kind of person is not a team player, and you are, you know, running a team. And I don't know, I just feel like there's a kind of push and pull between addressing the bottom line, you know, doing whatever the company is doing, and maintaining that team, and the fact that those two things are not as intrinsic as maybe they should be, could possibly be a problem here. And so, one of the solutions is to kind of address that company culture and make sure, because I mean, the problem with like instituting any kind of regulation on workforces or workplaces rather, is that you're not dealing with any kind of blanket culture. Is that you're dealing with all kinds of different dynamics between people and different hierarchies, which can be as diverse as anything, because there's no regulation for a kind of company culture, just things that work. And so I think you got to look at how in essence that kind of change is regulated. And I think it's entirely regulated by the bottom line. And so like, we have to prove that, not to just kind of repeat myself and ignore everything you've been saying, is that like we have to look at each of these problems or each of these answers and prove that they are not going to be like a financial problem. And I think that like we have – like there are certain policies that exist for making space for people who have like disabilities and things like that. Like I think you have to hire a certain amount of people with like disabilities or something like that, depending on what kind of company you are, I think. And so you make accommodations for that. And so obviously that somehow eats into your budget or whatever. But you made it. Like you made it happen, maybe again because it's the law. But you can do that for a woman who needs to be out for maternity leave or for her pregnancy. And that's a lot. But you can – I mean like people work from home and stuff like that. My dad works from home and he also works at the office. He brings us home with him. I think he's like the opposite. He's like a workaholic but he hates work, which I get maybe just an American. And so I think that I don't know who I'm talking to, but you can definitely make accommodations and that's like super important. And like, you know, specifically to this issue could be maybe one of the keys to it.
Well, yeah, a lot of like the gender topics we'll bring up today. There's a lot of like, especially with the military, which we'll get into. There's a lot of kind of like pitiful excuses where it's like, well, this is but to kind of keep rolling. And I think that the next one was going to be the glass ceiling, which I think it kind of relates closely to this because in the glass ceiling, there's always the idea that women can't get it, can't rise in the ranks as fast as men. And I learned tonight of terms like glass escalators and sticky floors.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't aware those were things, but absolutely, yeah, like we're men. As I mentioned before, should men and women work in the exact same field, men will get along higher? Or if men work in fields that are generally mainly occupied by women, they'll be paid faster, they'll be paid better, or women will just, you know, kind of stay where they are, like, just based on their gender, you know? And it's like, well, you know, they got to do the work, whatever. I mean, obviously, this is all including factors where they're doing the exact amount of work, working very hard, working just amount as hard as the men do in these instances, and for whatever reason, this just doesn't happen for them. Obviously, attention must be paid to not have those happen in the future, which I think is a very simple thing, but those are very strong realities that kind of continue to persist.
And I mean, with the glass ceiling, with negotiations, things like that, I feel like it's a problem that is going to kind of, or a solution that's kind of going to avalanche. I feel like one of the answers here is that you need to have women in the room who are hiring women and considering them for higher positions and things like that. Because not to say that they wouldn't be biased, but to say that men's bias has been so well known up until this point.
Consistently demonstrated.
Right, exactly. Like we always know what they're going to do, and they're always going to go with the man because it is that boys' club. You know, people want to hire who they know. Like that's the golden rule in Hollywood. I mean, I guess there's probably several golden rules, but the thing everybody always tells you is when you want to come to Hollywood, as I did, so I'm facing this now, is it's not what you know, but who you know. And so that's you just kind of realize that that's true of every job. That if you make it, the first people you're going to hire are your friends and the people you know, the people who help get you there. Maybe you're not just going to hire the quote unquote best person for the job, because the best person for the job is not, they don't know your inside joke about Daffy Duck or whatever. And that's like, maybe that's not great. And so that's a stupid thing to say. So how do we actually route that? And I think it's to have a better system in place for hiring. So I guess the first question is what is that better system? And then the second question is how do we implement that?
Yes, exactly. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, which I think leads nicely, because you mentioned Hollywood, into representation of women in the media. And at this point, I forget which one I wrote down, which one you wrote down. Understanding where/how bad representation manifests from male preference and the humanization of women. Right. So, in my opinion, a way which can just kind of eliminate bad representation in the media is basically kind of recognizing how women are perceived by men negatively, and you know, I guess a sort of a knee jerk reaction, you know, oh well, she doesn't, you know, she looks too old, or all that kind of stuff. Obviously, putting women in the forefront of, you know, making sure what is put in front of the camera, and basically, kind of, yeah, like humanizing women, like the famous, you know, sexy getting ready song from Grace's Girlfriend, that kind of thing, which some of us knew not of its existence, must be made, you know, must be normalized so that they can be seen as, you know, as this sounds so basic, but continue to be or start being seen as real people.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that's just not how the male gaze works. And again, it sounds silly, but that's, you know, that's true.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's one of those kind of things that kind of continues to persist. And that's in some ways I feel that, you know, there is progress being made, but in other ways it's like, you know, I'm not exactly sure how to get at this, because it's one of those things where it's like, is Michael Bay going to, you know, just be fired once we realize that this is an issue, or is it going to be phased out? I'm not sure. It's one of those things where it's like, will this lead to, like, you know, like a no sexualization stamp, or is it going to lead to, you know, well, men must be sexualized in the female gaze just as much? Like, it's one of those things where it's like, is it going to be sort of a negative, as in sort of a negative appearance thing, or is it going to be more of a positive thing? Is it going to be adding more, or is it going to be subtracting more? And I'm unsure, but I know that's sort of how representation in the media can come about, kind of just, you know, obviously putting on an equal playing ground and make sure that the effects of the image are definitely produced in a much more altered sense.
Yes, and I hate to say this, but I feel like the proflagration... What? I feel like the spread...
Go for it!
Proflagration? That is definitely not a word. But the
it is not. Neologism is the word I was thinking about last episode, like the made-up word.
Oh, totally, yes. Whoa, my name is Neil. Okay.
Nice.
But yeah, I think the popularization of the video essay on YouTube is definitely like, that is kind of essentially the promise of Anita Sarkeesian realized, except that, as Lindsay Ellis had pointed out or lamented a while ago, whenever like a big publication says that, like, oh, we're in the golden age of video essays on YouTube and lists everybody, it's all guys. It's all like the pop culture detective and Mr. Lessons from the Screenplay. And these guys were fine, but they're guys, right? But I feel like having a more popular and immediate form of criticism, which we don't really have from traditional outlets anymore, because like all the popular critics these days are like Roger Ebert, who's no longer with us, and Peter Travers.
Been dead for a while, I was going to say that, like, and maybe this be what I'm intaking, but, like, the popular critics, if they're not on, you know, The Atlantic or The New York Times or Forbes or whatever, they're on, like, the late-night hosts and people our age, like, people on YouTube.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's not to say that those guys are the more traditional guys are bad. Like, I really like Wesley Morris. I think Mark Kermode is kind of funny. And he really likes David Cronenberg. But, like, yeah, I mean, like, you know, you mentioned Chris Stuckman, I think, already. He already came up in this podcast.
Probably before we started the show.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, actually. And, you know, guys like that, like, very, very popular. And they have this power to kind of possibly hold media accountable for things. And I mean, we saw that exactly with Anita Sarkeesian and Dishonored or Arcane Studios. I mean, those guys like made a conscious effort to like hire more women and think about women after their game was criticized. And I think like specifically Harvey Smith had said that was an influence. I mean, video game companies have like had Anita Sarkeesian, like they've gone to like her consultations or whatever and things like that. Like,
oh, they have? Awesome.
Yeah, I think maybe Bungie, but maybe not. But like, you know, that's a real thing. Like media criticism, media policing, perhaps, that's a real thing. And definitely it points out these issues that are definitely a huge goddamn problem. Because, media is kind of our first contact for new ideas and new images. And if those images come at you poorly, like a trans panic episode of a certain popular animated Fox sitcom, like that might really not necessarily create your idea of what a trans person is, but definitely confirm it in that very locker room talk kind of way.
Well said. Very well said.
Thank you.
I'd agree, because there is a very healthy flux of online YouTube critics. But I mean, Lindsay Ellis is one I've enjoyed for years, and like I think she's, you know, been firing all cylinders lately. Like, she had one. I don't know how much you watch her, but like she had one about Saving Mr. Banks and like Disney, which I thought was very, very engaging.
I just watched that.
I thought it was great. Which is more about Disney than women, but like, yeah. the next bit, would you mind getting this? Because I did not know what Emily's List was until I looked at this doc. But this is about representation of women in politics, specifically.
Yeah, and I don't know exactly what Emily's list is because I don't know politics, if they're like a lobby or like an interest group or whatever the terminology is, but they're some kind of organization that will promote women candidacy, so probably putting money into their campaigns, things like that. And whenever we do get around to talking about democracy, we'll talk about, you know, the ethics of like super PACs and Citizens United and all that stuff, putting money in elections and things like that. But, you know, in this case, like, putting that aside, like, I think the ethical problem at the heart of Emily's list is women candidates at all cost, yay or nay. And I think that in 2016, in the primaries, maybe not the primaries, but in the actual election, we decidedly said nay, that, you know, Hillary Clinton was too compromised. She was too much of a war hawk. All these different things, all the scandals in the 90s, she's not good enough. And you might say that you wanted a woman president, but clearly you didn't.
Yeah, if she was in office, it would just be scandal after scandal after scandal. She wouldn't be able to get anything done.
Yeah. Hindsight. It's 2020.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, so Emily's List is essentially a group that tries to have pro-life women Democrats elected to office, correct?
Ah, okay.
And sure, I mean, yeah, that is a I'm sure if it's not pro-life, I think it's pro-choice. Why did I say pro-life?
Oh, okay, that would have been kind of weird because I think that would narrow the pool significantly.
Yeah. I think that it's pro-choice because I don't. One thing I don't know of is the percentage of women that are pro-choice and the percentage of women that are pro-life total, or at least even in America. Mm. But I know that a lot of its policies are decided by men. So you know. Having women, and I remember watching one of the debates and having like Donald Trump just like flat out lies about abortion, and Hillary Clinton just saying that's like none of that is even kind of fucking true.
Yeah,
she said the fucking truth. She said the word fucking. You see in her eyes, but that kind of thing where it's like you can't possibly have men lie for their own benefit. There was one guy who was fired today or quit today because he's pro life and yet he told his mistress to get an abortion. Never mind.
Oh, yes. Excellent. Waka. Excellent.
But it's that kind of hypocrisy in action that kind of calls for more women to be in office. Not only for that hypocrisy, but, like, you know, I think abortion in of itself, obviously, is a very tender debate, which is not – I still don't find there to be an easy answer. But it's not being given as much discussion from the men who just say no publicly, yeah. I should say.
Gosh, I mean, one of the earliest lines in the 2016 election cycle was, don't just vote for Hillary because she's a woman. And I feel like, not to sound too much like a woman, but that was like so gaslighting because it kind of obviates the consideration of what a woman's experience grants a woman candidate. And it's so much. And it's definitely not, you know, it's definitely not miseducation about what abortions are. Like, I think they just passed a ban on 20-week abortion or something, which is going to be disastrous. And like somebody had tweeted something that was like, at this point we should should we bar like men and young boys from like healthcare? Because like that's essentially what this is. I mean, you're taking healthcare away from women, access to their own fucking bodies, control over their bodies. And at the very least, I gotta think that like women candidates would care about that or at least know about it. To some extent, and then like that's like so important, and so like voting for somebody just because she's a woman doesn't sound as fucking stupid as maybe you thought it was, and that's like god damn it, like talk about a fucking late thought to have occurred to people. But yeah, I mean, but how do we actually get women in office? I don't know, but I would guess pay attention to organizations like Emily's List, kind of decide on your own. If they're okay or not, look at their candidates, I suppose, who they're supporting. Organizations like MoveOn.org and Swing Left or whatever, anybody who kind of, you know, puts money into people's campaigns and supports things like that, you know, be careful about where you put your money or wherever or whatever. And I don't know, I guess just like care, because I think that was also a crucial ingredient that may have been missing is actually care about like women in politics, and this sounds completely condescending, but it's not like I did either. Like, this wasn't really a reality to me up until this year or last year, I suppose. You know, the idea that this was like super important because like everything counts in politics, you know, where they draw the fucking lines. Like they're talking about gerrymandering right now on like the national level, and like it all matters. And so women in politics is like supremely important. It's just that, again, this is another one where we come up short, I think.
Well, it's also, yeah, I think another way that can help before we move on is like, you know, having more men campaign for them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I would have thought that Barack Obama is saying, you know, there hasn't been no one else more qualified for the office than Hillary Rodham Clinton. Would have done good. Maybe it did where it counted, but like, I think the idea that like women who run for things are always doing it on their own with like no, you know, like they're kind of doing it in their own kind of little bubble, and like I mean, this is not a great comparison, but like I never saw really any man say they're going to vote for Jill Stein.
No, but worth considering anyway. But yes, I get. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean. So it's one of those things where I think that, like, you know, women, the idea of women in politics shouldn't be limited to just the ones we know, like Nancy Pelosi and
Warren.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren and Hillary Clinton. They should be normalized, and I think men should campaign for them. Especially if they are like, you know, obviously, like, you know, when we had like, you know, superstars like Sarah Palin, they did that because she towed the party line, but yeah. Democrats, male Democrats should definitely be much more up for them visibly and publicly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really strong consideration. And I think that ultimately, like, it's also a matter of like, not to say encourage young girls, but do not discourage or push back on the discouragement that is facing them. And you know, work to cultivate the kind of environment that will actually, you know, not turn them away, because people are interested in all kinds of things, but until they actually enter that world and realize how toxic it is, that's when you start to turn people away, people who might have actually done some good. And also I think that also kind of relates to how we view, women politicians in general, you know, not only Hillary Clinton, but we also kind of see them as like interchangeable. And when we're putting them against each other, like, oh, Kamala Harris, she's not that great. She's at one point she was the replacement for Hillary Clinton. Now she just sucks. And now who cares? And then maybe she's great again. And it's just like it's so weird the way we kind of pass judgment on them. Not to say that we don't pass judgment on male politicians with any kind of or with that kind of intensity. But I just want to make sure that we are kind of reconsidering how we view women politicians, because it might be related to how we view women, which is to say somewhat biased. And that might be hurting us too in that sense.
Would you believe?
Would you believe it?
The next bit I'm going to mention briefly, because I think it was fairly related to the pay gap thing in terms of like, what we could possibly talk about. But like representation of women in the workplace and what is written down for possible solutions is understanding/compensating for pregnancy, which would include flexibility of hours and child care. Or not necessarily child care, I guess, but you know, I was in paid maternity leave. And taking sexual harassment seriously, which is a must, absolutely.
That's huge, yeah.
And I thought gender-neutral bonding outside the workplace, which I saw in one article, a lot of these, you know, a lot of guys, like, you know, play those not tennis games and steam games and stuff. Like, the kind of stuff that we kind of see, it's seen as kind of male bonding. But yeah, in my work experience, when you're at Kroger and you're bagging things for hours and there's no one around, so you talk about stuff, especially if you go to the same school or you go to competing schools, eventually you'll hang out afterwards if there's like some sort of like party going on or some sort of like, you know, water park going on. Like, I think that a positive work experience is always increased by, you know, teamwork and bonding through that work experience, especially if it is like, you know, mixed genders. I think goes a long way. It also helps to, and this is not anything that people can help, but I think people with the same age range could be useful too. So, I mean, this has nothing to do with anything, but maybe, you know, you're not only hiring like women, but women of different ages who are if you're bonding in different ways, crossing different experiences, then the team would be stronger, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, that's interesting. And it makes me think of, like, you know, team building exercises and how those are kind of parodied on popular media, as well as the sexual harassment VHS tape that they put in to their VHS player in the sexual harassment episode of whatever show it is. And I feel like I would love – I wish I had a better insight on how sexual harassment education actually worked in the workplace, because I've never been on a job where that's been a factor, I don't think. Maybe at like the grocery store, they might have had like a 5-second meeting of like half the cashiers or whatever, because you have to do things in that kind of rotating shift. So the company culture is kind of fragmented as is. But, you know, like, how do we make that process stronger? And obviously that statement is presumptuous because I don't know how it works. But clearly it hasn't necessarily been as effectual as maybe we would want it, which is to say, I was reading stories today about how Harvey Weinstein was, you know, on his way out from TWC because of harassment allegations, making him the next powerful old dude in Hollywood after Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly, who's faced this kind of situation, or faced this situation, put himself into this fucking fire.
who went up against this thing that he didn't do.
Yes, exactly. And like, you know, how do we, like, that's the, it wasn't Ash, oh, it was Ashley Judd who was talking about how, you know, when she was first starting out, she was invited up to Weinstein's room, and he was like in a bathrobe, and he was like, "Do you like watch me take a shower?" And she was like, "How do I turn him down without insulting one of the most powerful guys in Hollywood?" And so, like, how do we prevent that situation from happening? And like, I feel like that's such a huge question for not only the workplace but also in Hollywood and things like that, where the process for coming up is again through relationships. And I feel like, I mean, that's a general for all in America or whatever. So how do we prevent that specific, or not even that specific, but it is kind of a specific, but it is also like the experience of like pretty much like everyone, if you believe what you read on the internet, which I tend to, like the experience of like a majority of women in the workforce will have experienced sexual harassment. And it's just like, well, how the fuck did we get there? Like, how did we fuck ourselves into this corner? And we must then be able to unfuck ourselves, because Jesus Christ, this is not like a natural, well, it is kind of a natural occurrence, but like, Jesus Christ, like, seriously, how do we get the hell out of this?
Well, it's like one of those things where everyone recognizes, again, this is always like my frustration and consternation with life. It's like everyone recognizes sexual harassment is wrong. It's like, how do you just get to a point where, like, you know, yes, as a pushing 30-year-old guy, like, you know, I've been taught since I was very young that like sexual harassment is bad, and yet you still have guys, you know, up to now, just want to watch have women watch them touch their dick. Like, what is up with that? Like, how does that? That's not the question. That's how that happens is not the question, or why people do that. That's not the question. The question is you know, why is that? You know, what, I don't know. What makes that acceptable? I guess. I know I'm asking the wrong question, but that's the question that pops in my head the strongest.
No, I mean, I think that makes sense, and it kind of lets. It's like there's a lot of protections in place for that activity to happen. And I mean, it's exactly like what happens in the Catholic Church, is chronicled in Spotlight, which is the only way I don't know about that. Not really, but kind of. Like, how do we remove those? I guess that's about transparency too. Is that if fucking Harvey Weinstein wants to take a shower and have Ashley Judd watch him, that we all watch him essentially, which, you know, that's a price to pay. But I don't want to say that these people don't know that it's not sexual harassment when they're doing these things, because that's going to give them too much credit. But if that was the case, I mean, that would just be a case for, okay, well, let's just get in there and make sure people understand. And I don't think that we do understand by and large the intricacies or even the generals of sexual harassment and things like that. So definitely up the education as a start. But for people who are just taking advantage of a system, how do we dismantle that system to protect these people? That's one that we're going to have to come back to at a later date.
Absolutely. Now, I really want to talk about this next bit, representation of women in professional sports, because I think this is going to be like, up to this now, the media's conversation. I mean, first of all, I thought, and I put very little thought into this, like maybe we should eliminate gender binary competitive sports, as in, you know, there is no NBA and WNBA, there is the NBA, i.e., men and women on the same team playing basketball, men and women competing against each other for, because I guess that's not normalized, but tennis and stuff, soccer, and I'm sure, you know, that might involve, like, you know, potential sexual harassment amongst teams and stuff, but like, ideally, in the ideal future, separate, like the women's team and all that kind of stuff would not be a thing, because that just kind of leads to more discrimination and, you know, lack of interest and not taking women seriously if they are sort of, you know, segregated in that way. Do you think that's a feasible idea, or is there an element to that that I'm not considering?
I mean, I think this one is going to be a lot like the military one. And I mean, I think that that's probably the best way to go. And I guess it is important to point out, like, why this would be important. And that's just because I think that a lot of women's professional teams are kind of marginalized, or rather organizations. Like, obviously, the WNBA is kind of like this long-running joke in American culture.
Futurama.
Yeah, exactly. Even in the future. And then, like, you know, like one of our best teams is, like, the Revolution, right? And, like, nobody ever talks about them. Like, I feel like whenever it was, like the U.S. has never, like, successfully won, like, a World Cup in soccer, but it's like, the women did. I think I
Yes, we did.
Yeah, it's like, Jesus Christ, guys. Like, the only time we ever pay attention to women's sports is beach volleyball in the Summer Olympics, I guess. And, like, maybe that's not the biggest problem ever, but, you know, there's a lot of women who want to be competing at the top levels, and they can't. For reasons why I don't understand, frankly, entirely. But it is important to say that one of the things that stands in the way of integrating genders in professional sports is sexual violence. But before we get there, another argument against why women shouldn't be allowed to play with the boys or whatever is because of, like, distraction. Is that the case here also? Because I feel like it
is. Do you want to save that bit for the military bit?
Yeah, sure. And so I guess the other thing is, like, they wouldn't be able to. And that's actually a little bit more complicated. I've worked this through the logic ringer, which is, I guess, the highest scientific research I can do. But, a man and a woman, like, they are not in any way different biologically, in any way that matters, unless you're talking about, like, pregnancy and hormones or something. But still, in terms of, like, aptitude for certain things, like, there's basically no difference. And my measure for that has always been who can win in a fight in terms of, like, the battle of the sexes. And there's not all of the arguments for why men are superior in this way do not hold up to any kind of again logic.
No.
That is off the table. However, because, like, in fighting, for example, in, like, mixed martial arts, which is kind of like the crucible or the laboratory for this kind of thought experiment, you know, brute strength and size, which men have the advantage in, is not the only element. It's only one of many elements, which is why I think Michael Jai White recanted on his statement that he could beat Bruce Lee in a fight. But maybe it was just because it was such an unpopular idea. I don't know. But I think it's true that – yes, we have weight classes in fighting right now, but in the beginning of mixed martial arts, we didn't. And in the Kumite, we don't.
These days.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I mean, the MMA started because people watch Enter the Dragon, and that's also where, you know, Jean-Pierre Melville, Jean-Claude Van Damme comes from.
I didn't know that MMA started because of Enter the Dragon.
Yeah, that scene with Bolo Young, I think, or Sammo Hung, I don't know.
Bolo Young.
I don't know, Chinaman. So a woman at any point could beat a man in a fight if she was, like, you know, up to it in her, like, if she trained or whatever, because she can use her mind and her speed and her flexibility, all that stuff, whatever. There are multiple considerations put against each other, not just brute strength. However, if you're, like, a defensive lineman in football, brute strength is kind of a situation, and we wouldn't want huge, like, you know, 300-pound dudes who are, like, somehow pure muscle hitting women at full force, because women's bodies are not designed to handle that, nobody's bodies are designed to handle that. Obviously, that's why football should be illegal, as my favorite feminist says. And you know, we're seeing that a lot coming up every now and again with, you know, concussions and all that stuff, but yes, that is one area where it's a little bit more complicated. Having a woman quarterback or whatever, or like a kicker, like, that's always kind of been, like, if you're going to have a movie where there's, like, women on the team, like, that's usually the jobs they'll do, which is crazy because I feel like the quarterback is the people everybody goes after, but whatever. Oh my God, somebody's just sitting out there blaring.
Someone's just been shot and fell over their wheelchair. Their
yes, goddamn you. Come out there and kill you again. But I feel like the push for this begins with normalizing the idea. And yes, that would come from representation in the media. Pitch was a show on Fox about the first female MLB pitcher that got canceled. It sucked. She was fine, but the show focused almost entirely on like the guy, which was like a weird bait and switch. Yeah, it was so bizarre. But you know, like we had that once, we never had it again. How old is A League of Our Own? Like that movie is old as shit. Like Rosie O'Donnell was in that movie.
I've still not seen it, but I mean, I'm pretty sure that was out before I was born.
Yeah, gosh. Oh man, Gina Davis, Tom Hanks. I guess they're still around, but but yeah, I think that's where that one comes in. And yeah, that kind of segues nicely into the next one.
Yeah, this next part, I'm scrolling to see on my phone to see like the specific phrasing of it, but eliminate sex verification for females. Now, this is a thing that I remember happening around 2009 with Caster Semenya, who's a South African distance runner in the Olympics, and she was being accused of illegally participating in women's teams because, or the women's races, because her gender, her female gender, was put into question because she's a very if you've not seen her, she is a very a rather muscular woman for a woman, as one might perceive her to be. So she was tested to make sure that she was a real woman. There was accusations, unfounded accusations of her being intersex, or what's the word that starts with an H?
Hermaphroditic.
Hermaphroditic, yeah. All this is unfounded, and it wasn't publicly released, like, you know, specifically what her gender was, but she was clear to continue participating in these games. And it's one of those things where people are arguing, like, well, she has a larger bout of testosterone running through her veins. That's not fair because women aren't supposed to do that. A related instance was with, I don't know, I'm sure how to pronounce her name, Duty Chand, who was also a similar runner, during the Commonwealth Games, she was tested for doping because she was seen as too good, and women can't be that physically fit. And this is one of those things, like, I mean, I looked a lot of this up. I mean, I remember very well the Caster Semenya thing going on, but like apparently like sex chromosome testing has been a thing since like, goes back to like the late 30s and at least since the 60s, just to make sure that women have the right chromosomes and stuff. And I feel that like that's insane. there's definitely like the I think the question is definitely expanded with the rising visibility of the trans community, but on its face, you know, just making sure that women don't have too much testosterone in there. Like what? I'd love to know what your thoughts are on this instance in women's sports.
Oh yeah, man. I mean, it's still I guess those thoughts are a work in progress. Actually, this is like primarily the subject that Caitlin Burns writes about, which is the author that we talked about a lot on the Call Out Culture / Louis C.K. / Joss Whedon episode.
The Louis C. Whedon episode.
Yeah, it's a little disorganized, but I liked it. Where I swear to God, I read other authors, not just Caitlin Burns, but I think she primarily, like, on her Patreon, she talks about gender in athletics or whatever. And, you know, that's a really important consideration and one that kind of gums up the works of progress, I suppose, because it is very complicated. Like, there's the element of physical aptitude and whether or not like testosterone and the male body ability to grow more muscle or whatever, or develop more muscle is a disadvantage or an advantage. We measure the womanhood of a trans woman by like what's inside, but what's outside is what's important for sports. And that sounds completely transphobic, I apologize, but I don't know how to better express that as I'm just running my mouth at 100 miles an hour.
podcast, yes. Yeah. Do you remember the Caster Semenya thing?
I mean, maybe. I don't know the name, but yeah, I feel like that case. Yeah.
Yeah, I was in college when that was going on, and I just remember that being... of course, you know, this is 2009, so whatever I thought about the, you know, intersex community or people who have, you know, different assigned chromosomes or whichever, I just remember thinking that, like, this is, like, I just felt so bad for her because it was genuinely just, like, this, like, public humiliation on an insane scale. You're training and you're doing this, because she was 18 years old at the time.
Oh, Jesus.
This is one of those things where, like, you know, you're training and you're working out and you're on the Olympic Games level and you're being, you know, brought out and people are saying all these things about you that aren't true for this reason or whatever. I mean, there's also the question of sexuality there. She's gay. She's married a woman since. But it's one of those things where it's like, you know, there was I think some guy had said, you know, it's just like, I think it's in the equivalent of like, I know it when I see it or whatever. And of course it was a guy. But it was just like,
yeah,
it was that kind of thing. That element of women can be competitive and this, whatever, but if we still have to, you know that they're women kind of thing going on. I did not know sex verification for females was at all a thing. I didn't know that was a thing that had existed for over 50 years. It's just you can't be serious.
Oh. Yeah, sad state.
Yeah, that is a hell of a thing. I just don't know what they. I think kind of back to like what you're talking about. You know, the whole distraction bit, which will blend into the military aspect, representation of the military. I remember there was a line in, I believe it was the Outsiders comic book, which I did. I gave my trades to Jan because I didn't like it.
Take my trash.
Yeah. It's Jen Winnick wrote it, and like it was a line where like. You know, you have all these superheroes, very, very athletic characters, both men and women, working together, fighting together, nearly dying together, all hot and sweaty. There's got to be sexual tension, which is realistic and makes sense. But it's also kind of that thing where it's like, I don't know where this is kind of leading sex representation-wise. Just because I was like, you know, in like cartoons like the Superman or whatever, you just don't talk about it. Right. So it's very much a realistic element of it. But at the same time, it's like, You never want the superhero genre to be kind of, you know, fodder for porn parody or whatever. And it's one of those things where it's like, you know, athletes should be seen as athletes. They shouldn't be seen as, you know, sexually viable commodities. I mean, I know that there's like, you know, the sort of naked Sports Illustrated covers, but I kind of see those. Of course, they're very sexualized, but I don't know. Like, I kind of view those as, you know, sort of like. Tributes to the athleticism of the human body. I don't necessarily see those as like, you know, spank material.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, who knows? I guess it's itself for because I don't subscribe to that publication. But that does remind me that I feel like it's probably true that like every major female athlete has been had a spread in Sports Illustrated or whatever. And that's just for some reason reminded me of Danica Patrick. Kind of an unrelated point, but like I feel like the idea that. Women are not up to the task is this weird – it might be true sometimes, but it is also used as a blanket argument for sports where that doesn't matter at all. And granted, we do flag under the stereotype that women are bad at driving, but like fucking Danica Patrick faced like significant blowback trying to be like one of the first major like NASCAR drivers as a woman. Like fucking – seriously? Like come on. Like that is driving a car. In a circle. Not to say that, like, she's not talented or whatever, but she can't be any, like, significantly less talented than Tom Gordon or whatever.
Yeah, it's like, you know, women can't do this. Fuck you.
Yeah.
I actually was going to say something else, but, like, the fuck you just came out of my mouth.
Yeah.
Do you want to, like, lay up the military discussion?
Sure, yeah. This one always depresses me, but let's do it.
Sorry.
It's all good. So the next consideration is representation in the military, which is pretty much related. I feel like a lot of the quote-unquote conclusions we drew about this previous topic were going to come up here. But some of the arguments against why women should be in combat roles, which I think has pretty much been reversed in America at least, is that they would distract us, that they're not up to the task again. No one should have to fight anyway, which kind of comes from the other side, the liberal side. And then the epidemic of sexual violence in the military, which is actually a serious concern. But going one by one, or actually, let's see what we have for answers. We have certain models around the world, like Israel, I think China, maybe North Korea, I don't know. But there is definitely precedent for women in combat roles around the world. And even historically, of course, training should, Training should up discipline. I wrote this. If distraction on the deadly battlefield is an issue, better system for reporting sex crimes, women in leadership positions. Do we look to anime for vision of the future? For example, Gits. I don't know what that is.
Robotech. Ghost in the Shell.
No, I'm just fucking with you. Various other future sci-fi war series.
That's me.
So, yeah. and I think that... I don't know what the number one... the number one argument against women's integration in the military is probably the idea that they're not up to the task. And, I mean, are they really not? Or do you just think that they're not? Because we haven't had a lot of precedent for women in those combat roles. And granted, like a lot of the women who have like tried to go in for that have like washed out. There's not a lot of great success stories there. But also think about, again, the environment that you are creating. Are you honestly, meaningfully cultivating those potential soldiers and officers and things like that? Jesus Christ. You'll see footage of like people who work in the Air Force and the Navy and work on like machines and their pilots and things. And there you'll see like people of all shapes and sizes and genders and things like that and race. But you don't get that in like the Marines or the Navy SEALs, or whatever. And obviously those are the Navy SEALs and Delta Force are a little bit different, I guess. But like combat roles, I guess. And I think that there's just that latent fear of a woman soldier that she wouldn't know the one end of the gun from the other. And she'd be too busy putting on her nail polish. I mean, this is simplifying the arguments, but they are kind of simple. And I don't honestly, I get maybe a little heated about this one. I don't say that to make myself sound like some champion for women, because honestly, we could, if we wanted to go dark on this, I could, but in terms of my motives, but like, well, actually, when we talk about Ghost in the Shell, we'll probably get there accidentally, but
what have I done?
Spoiler alert. But yeah, I mean, I don't understand. Well, I guess I do understand, but I think that's stupid.
If women are fighting with us, who can we protect at home? Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, it's just like our misunderstanding of the woman's body is also another like constant pattern in this whole discussion. Mm. And I think it comes up here too, is that we don't think women can be like Vasquez and aliens. Like, you know, has anybody ever mistaken you for a man? That was the worst Bill Paxton impression. But like, I mean, to be honest, like as a cisgender heterosexual guy, it did take a lot of logistical processing or logical processing to come up with that conclusion that women and men are not meaningfully different biologically when it comes to physical combat, which is like such a weird specific thing. But like women could absolutely like trek a huge backpack across the desert in the Middle East. They could absolutely defeat you in hand-to-hand combat and CQC, you know, solid snake style. Like there's nothing that they really can't do. As long as you fucking don't stand in their way the way you don't stand in the way of men and actually kind of, you know, run army recruitment ads on like Saturday morning cartoons and stuff and actually seek them out and encourage men to join the military, things like that. That also needs to change, be a little bit more open. But yeah.
No, yeah, exactly right. It's like, you know, if you're in a – it's like the whole, you know, if black people really wanted to be done with slavery, they should have, you know, made, you know, not been slaves, not wait for white people to do it for them kind of argument, where it's like, you know, stop talking about, you know, a perspective that you know nothing about and presuming the environment of that perspective. Like, it absolutely like tracks that, like, you know, being in a harsh, toxic, masculine environment like the military, where you're kind of, you know, beyond being taught to kill somebody, we're just kind of being in that realm where, like, it's very much celebrated as sort of a good old boys sort of thing. Like the military culture, which I know very much, very little of, but what little I do know of, is very much a sort of, you know, bare bones male kind of thing. To accept women kind of seems to be, you know, sort of a breach. It's like, you know, we can't have women in comic books and we can't have women in the military kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
So that's kind of like what they have to deal with. And if they want to do it, you know, there's a lot of psychological factors. There's going to be a lot of psychological restructuring in that. So to compound that with your male bullshit makes it untenable. So if you erase that and have everybody, you know, be just, you know, kind of go through the same military bullshit, then I'm sure they'll be fine. So, yeah, it always, it's one of those things where it's like, just where, you know, just try to just drown out your hatred of women just for 6 months or how long it takes to train.
Oh,
and see,
nice.
And see where you will be at the end of it.
And why is it that that is so hard for people? Man. So I feel like in this case, there's kind of an interesting chronology that presents itself where, and I think about this a lot, where things kind of have to happen in a certain order. Maybe not, but I always kind of assume that they will, which is representation in the media changes first, and then maybe military, and then politics and sports and things like that, because I feel like military is so huge. But will happen when the idea of the female soldier is normalized in society, when we think of them as capable to a pretty, you know, high standard as a U.S. Marine would be. I know my buddy was trying to enlist in the Army, and he was always talking about how hard that was. And I looked it up, and it didn't. But maybe it's different at the recruiting office. I don't know. Maybe they scare you or something. But yeah, that's a high standard. So we have to make sure that our media is not leading us astray and providing confirmation to the opposite, to the unreality that women are not up to the task. The other consideration, the second of three considerations here, is that once we do that, once we actually begin to have women in the military performing those roles, I think that's going to have a trickle-down effect for normalization, because that's like such a huge – it will strike such a huge blow against the idea that men and women are different on a fundamental biological way and that men are superior, because that can be routed. And once you prove that, you begin to normalize in other spaces where that argument has been used, like perhaps in the workplace, like, oh, a woman can't, I don't fucking know, not answer the phone or whatever. Like, she can't be a leader because she doesn't blah, 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 whatever. And then the final consideration there is, I have slung my thesis around about like the Atomic Blonde and You're Next, movies like that, where, Doomsday, where very believably women are killing men, and it doesn't look like, mm-hmm. again, the Joss Whedon kind of thing that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And some of a common response I've gotten is, yes, but I don't want to be that woman. You know, I don't want to be the kind of ideal feminist icon that you have created as, again, a cisgender male. Excuse me if that triggers you as a fellow cisgender male, that terminology. I don't know why I decided to be such a bitch.
Hey!
Sassy. Those words clearly trigger me to some extent. It's true. And this was kind of the original sin of my original podcast, The Battle Beyond Planet X, which was always, my entree into feminism was kind of chasing after the brass ring of creating the major, but for real, essentially in media and in real life, the kind of woman who could just fucking destroy you. And like, that was always my idea of an ideal person and as such an ideal woman. And so that's how I kind of shaped my feminism. And that's my cross to bear. Like, I still have to deal with that shit. And I think honestly, that crazy ass girlfriend, not to mention again and again and again, has kind of helped me reduce that a little bit, because the women on that show, sure, they could kick my ass, but like they're not, like, that's not what they're about. Just because anybody could, like, that's actually a pretty funny comment on that. There's a Cowboy Bebop scene from the movie on YouTube where he says to Electra, like, oh, like, as you know, the famous line.
Oh, yes.
I can't even remember it, but I like
it. I love a woman who can kick my ass.
Yeah, and some guy was like, yeah, I agree, but it would be hard to find a woman who couldn't. Which is true in my case as well. But it's just like that's – it's not every woman is going to want to be like that. And I think it's tempting at that point to say, well, obviously they're conditioned by our patriarchal society. But, you know, I think in this case, defer to a woman's authority, and I'm speaking to myself, age 20 or 23 rather, which is to say a few months ago, because it is very important, but it's not important for everybody. And I think that it can do a lot of good. But, you know, some people's ideal feminist icon is Furiosa and not the Major or whatever. And that has, like, that was always my fundamental misunderstanding of Mad Max Fury Road, is that I thought people were thinking that Furiosa was a different character than they were perceiving her. But that's an argument that is older than I care to even think about. So moving on.
Yeah, when I listed some of the anime examples, because, you know, Robotech specifically, not just Macross, but like the Masters, and I've not seen Masvita. But if you most of the main characters in Robotech Masters is like Dana Sterling and Musica and other characters that I barely remember from 20 years ago because I don't watch it recently. But I was actually kind of thinking that like in Robotech in the Macross saga, actually the majority of them are men. But like later on, you know, you have Miria, who's like this hotshot killer, like fighter pilot who joins the good guys, and not a word is made up about it. And she's like one of the best fighters in the entire entire force. And it's one of those things where it's like when you kind of see them all together, she does kind of stand out, but she only kind of stands out for her green hair and like and the fact that she's not human. But otherwise, she does stand right alongside them. Then you go into the Master stuff, and it's mostly women who make up of all the kind of army. And in my head, I'm thinking of more shows where it's a very very kind of gender neutral gang of fighters and stuff. But you know, I mean, you have kind of things like Animorphs, where like there is a very serious kind of, you know, humans versus aliens kind of war, where like it was made up of like kids, boys, both boys and girls, and like it's not. You know, I'm not being indoctrinated with some sort of commentary on the realism between the difference between the male body and the female body, like Cassandra Cain is kind of this small Asian girl who like just wrecks people and like. And, you know, her size is kind of brought up in the comics, but, like, when I'm reading those comics when I'm 16 years old, I'm not thinking to myself, like, this is unrealistic, because, like, I'm thinking to myself, wow, she just did that shit awesome. So I think if you normalize the idea and normalize the image and recognize that it's real and not just make-believe or just some stuff from Japan, like, it can be – normalization makes things real, and aspirational images come into being and become real and you know, just try to kind of unlearn the idea that women can't, which is, again, another basic quote. But I, as you say, you know, you don't want to kind of say, well, the patriarchy has kind of made women conditioned to not want to be male. Just kind of work on not talking down to anybody and then see what they want to do. Without the goal of, you know, brainwashing them by unbrainwashing them, exactly. Just concentrate on not talking down to anybody, and then we'll see how things are 30 years from now, if there is a change, and kind of see where things may have come from.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so this is definitely not a call for, like, to kind of boost encouragement, but rather reduce discouragement. And I feel like, you know, just make sure that for the young girl in your life, hopefully a daughter, that you have as many options open to her as you would your son. Because I feel like, you know, you're not a bad parent if you don't. That's just kind of how we are trained to think as a society. Speaking of programming and training, and just kind of make sure you kind of check your own. Now I'm condescending to parents, so I don't know. But yeah, that's driving. And definitely for all of us, it definitely helps to have those kinds of normalizing images, because I would agree that normalization makes it real. Neo,
you said it was real.
But then the other consideration is that once we have women in the military, as we do, there's this fucking horrendous, very powerful documentary about a horrendous subject called The Invisible War, that I could not, one of the only movies aside from like Takashi Miike stuff that I could not finish because it was too intense, talking about how like following like a few women who were survivors of sexual assault in the military, and how the numbers on that are fucking staggering. Like, I think Amelia Bonner actually talks about this too, but like, it's so much worse than how it is in larger society, because the cultures of the military are so masculine and toxicity of masculinity, and like, you know, everybody's like swinging their dicks around, and so like that is kind of about like dominance and manipulation and proving oneself, and so rape is just kind of like this. I don't know how to phrase this, but like perfect consequence that it is like the military is like this machine that produces rape, it kills me. It's probably the thing about the world I like the least or hate the most, or what, that was a weird way to say it. Because like they're all like, when the scandals come out, they're like, they're insane. Like officers had like these prostitution rings of their own women soldiers, like their own people. And you know, the system for reporting these crimes is like fucking you have to like report to the guy who fucking raped you. It's essentially that bad. And it's just like, imagine like the worst society for reporting sex crimes, and just multiply that for the military. And this is the American military. Like, imagine how bad it is for countries who are kind of like not as good as us in general. Like, it's just it's a goddamn nightmare. And that requires better oversight and women in leadership positions, I suppose. People to actually hear reports of these things and care enough to do something about it, because something needs to be done urgently. And that needs to be sorted out before we start fucking encouraging young girls to be soldiers, because nobody should have to deal with that when they're trying to fucking serve our country. I mean, we talk about supporting our troops, but so anyway.
Do you know when that documentary come out?
I think like 2002. It's on Netflix. It might still be.
Do you have any idea of any action has been taken since?
I'm pretty sure it's just as bad as it was.
Okay, moving on. The last thing we have here is male genocide.
End on a good joke. The closer.
Yeah. I don't have much to say about this, to be honest, because I've not seen evidence that male genocide is as much of a troublesome concept to impede progress as much as all the others have been.
Really? Well, I think it's kind of the thing that underlies it all.
That's the heart of like misogyny, the idea that like women encroaching in men's spaces will push men out and replace them.
I have to think. I mean, I think that when it comes to the violences of men against women, generally emotional, physical, psychological, whatever, part of it is this fear of being replaced. Part of it is the dehumanization, that is, men just do not see women as fully human. Part of it could be mental illness or whatever. But I think, male genocide is a pretty big one. And granted, we did talk about this on an episode previous, but
Was that white genocide or male genocide? I think it was white genocide.
Yeah, it was probably more white genocide. Which I guess we'll come to eventually on the next episode, surely. Because
yeah, there's no way.
This is the last point we're gonna make. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think male genocide is a really important thing to address here, because I guess it's a question of like, what are we really talking about when we are arguing, or when we are going to have this argument about male genocide? And I really want to get that conversation started so that we arrive prepared. To that moment where we have to address that anxiety, because honestly, I really do feel that if we could alleviate that anxiety completely, then a great deal of sexism would go away in the heart of that man. So for me, it's a question of how do we get there? How do we assuage that fear?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I kind of just need like. That's tough for me because at this point it's hard for me to kind of really, kind of see the inference. I mean we're talking about like sexism in the military, and the workplace, all that kind of stuff. It's not that I necessarily empathize with it, but like I can visibly understand how that comes to be. But the male genocide, it seems like this sort of like overreaction that
sure.
that is hard for me to kind of, you know, kind of like how is, you know. You know, women's existence, you know, been so threatening because like human history has been occupied by the shared space between men and women. Like, it's I'm failing this conversation because I really can't think of the argument. I really can't think of the pro side. I suck.
Well, that's our liberal failure too. I mean, that's my problem as well, is that I don't understand enough about this anxiety, which is maybe just I haven't dug enough into myself. To be honest with you, or whatever. But yeah, I mean, to identify this problem, which does not exist, but it does for these people, for the key holders and the gatekeepers, that's the thing. Yeah.
I have an example.
Okay.
There was when Felicia Day had announced her pregnancy. I don't think she's had her child since. When she
announced, I thought she did.
No, I think she did. Yeah, when her baby was born, people were like, "Oh, I didn't know she had a boy. I don't. Have I mentioned this before? I don't know if she had a boyfriend, or I don't know if she was married, or I didn't know she was with anybody.
I didn't know that.
Well, no.
Immaculate Conception?
Yeah, that's what it was. And I remember seeing somebody on Facebook saying, how dare these people just presume that she's with anybody? She doesn't need to be with anybody to have a baby. And I'm like,
true.
I do remember, yeah, I'm like, scientifically, yes, that's true. But I do remember being like, okay, well, like, I don't think that, like, a woman being, you know, having a kid on her own with artificial insemination. I never thought that that was, like, normalized to the point of an everyday kind of thing where that's no. A popular kind of thing. So I felt resentment because it was the person who said that was a woman. And I was like, well, I don't think that that's something that people should expect every time they hear that someone had a baby.
Yeah.
And maybe that ties into it somewhere. It's like, I don't know, the threat of the removal of the man from the family unit or whatever with single working moms or something like that. Maybe I presume that's somewhat related.
Mm. Gosh, man. Well, that's interesting. That reminds me of the idea of fatherhood becoming a little bit more like masculinity itself being a little bit more emotional and stuff like that. I mean, we always talk about – not we, but you know, liberal people always talk about how we kind of put everything on the mom and then blame her for everything also. And again, this will fall back to the media, but it was really that's not really a good example, but I feel like to first get better examples of non-toxic males in media and then to see them as fathers, because I feel like a lot of TV nowadays is kind of like I'm like a comedian or something, and I'm going to tell my story and perhaps name the show after myself. But I feel like a lot of these people are like Aziz Ansari, and they're like dealing with parenthood even from a distance. And I feel like to normalize fatherhood, the way like my father is, to make that more popular of an idea, would be great. Cause I think my parents, delegate their, parental responsibilities equally and not gendered at all. Like my dad, would cook because he knows how to cook, and my mom, she bakes, I suppose, but she wouldn't really do that. But he also did like all the carpentry, and he was like constantly adding additions to the house. And so like my mom wouldn't do that. She wouldn't like wear a hard hat. I didn't grow up in like some absurd feminist household or something.
It wasn't growing pains where Alan Thicke was staying home and Joanna Kearns was outside.
Yeah. Right. Wasn't quite that, but you know, definitely like a little bit of a blur of, roles as we see them. And I think that in conjunction with caring enough about women, for example, perhaps Felicia Day, and their successes, could kind of be like if you find yourself rooting for a woman, even like a celebrity, I think that's probably a good start that you, even if it's in the same industry, you don't care if she gets that job before you do, because you care about her getting the job perhaps just as much as you do. And you're happy that she, I don't know, fucking Christ. I mean, this is the first time I'm like really trying to think about male genocide, because yes, it is so stupid. Like it doesn't make any goddamn sense, but
there is a website out there when I had the balls to Google this, where a woman a few years ago who went by the name Femme Theist, you can see where this is going, I think she joked about male genocide, and then like double down on, well, maybe if we left 10% of the male population alive for breeding purposes, the world would be a better place. And like people were like we're interviewing, like, oh, do you really think this is, oh yeah, I think this would be an interesting idea. And I didn't really put too much stock into it because obviously she's insane, but because you know, like you gotta stop it when you're calling upon the death of people. But like it's one of those things where like she would be, you know, the like on the escaped list of Arkham inmates list of the MRA, where it's like, you know, she represents all of women kind of thing, where it's like,
yep,
even if there is a sort of like the fringe elements, it's just not enough to like, you know, take seriously, you fools.
Right. I mean, the term feminazi is a thing, and like to analogize feminists to Nazis, and to the classical definition of Nazi, which is not to say like the White House, but you know, 1940s people who committed genocide against the Jews and several minority groups. Like that's I guess that is pretty telling and comes from not only an ahistoric perspective, but an incredibly privileged one. But again, this isn't about just bashing people who believe in this. Obviously, just so absurd, I don't have language strong enough to condemn it. But, like, so how do we interface with that mindset? And the first consideration is how do we understand it? And so I think this is going to take some independent research on both of us.
This has got to be an episode on itself.
Report back, yeah. Not the next one, certainly. But, yes, we're going to have to follow up on this one because I do think it's pretty important. I think that that's kind of be a one of the conversations that we can have. People like us who aren't talking to Reed Hastings or to, you know, the Weinsteins or whoever is in power in Hollywood or whatever. But to people who believe in this shit, like on Twitter. Like, how do we arm ourselves to deal with those people and convert them? Because I would rather convert people ideologically than murder them. And I feel like a lot of you guys are talking about murder when it comes to this stuff. And I understand that you're not, that, you know, Antifa violence is violence and self-defense. But just fucking consider how you're interfacing in the end game, in the Highlander end game, the final dimension, how we are actually going to convince people of our future. Like, what does that conversation look like? And we're going to have to return to this one.
Yes. So we're not going to have enough time to go into all these points because we're just getting done with the very first one, which was about gender.
Yeah, well, I think that's the episode, actually.
Yeah, did you want to get any bit about gun control, or do you think that's too much?
No, I don't want to skimp on it.
Okay, no, that's fair.
I mean, this is the first episode that we're recording after the Las Vegas shooting, and so, like, you know, it's on our minds.
Right, yeah. I mean, this could be sort of like a series of things. It's like your tortured masterworks or whatever.
Yeah, as infrequently. Hopefully we do those a little bit more regularly. But right.
Yeah, so this will be like a Sell Me the Future : gender.
Gender,
equality.
Yeah. And then the next one will be part two, gun control, the quickening.
The source. Who are you?
Yes.
I'm the guardian. So yeah, I think that, I mean, that's definitely a meaty episode. And I'm glad this won't be 2 hours. This is easier to edit, quite frankly.
Yeah. It's already longer than most of them.
Right. But yeah, I honestly think that we did better than I was thinking because there's so many to talk about just in the gender equality tangent alone.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways that we invent excuses to justify hatred of women.
Yes.
You know, like dating isn't everything, guys. So if you have thoughts on how the world, the future might look when gender equality is achieved, please write in at qnoanswers@gmail.com.
Yes, absolutely. Please. Please.
Pretty please. Okay, so for next episode, dating. It's something that everyone likes to do or everyone avoids. Or if you're other people, you just, you know, have your own way of going about it. But dating, it's a thing that kind of guarantees the future of our race. Unless you're assigned a partner, but of course that's not necessarily the topic. Anyways, I'm babbling. We'll be talking about dating, how people have dated in the past, how people date now, and how dating might end up in the future. It's going to be another saucy episode with your saucy host talking about saucy things with lots of tomato sauce. So bring your gloves.
Goodness gracious. I'm excited.
Excellent. So if you have thoughts on dating or this episode's topic, again, that email address is qnoanswers@gmail.com. So is there anything else to talk about for this episode? Hairs?
Be cool, man. Be cool.
Yes. Super cool. As the Tim Roth would say.
We are role models, really. I mean, that's how I always thought of myself. So I'll just leave that then.
Do what we mean, what we say. Adios.
来希望自己